Okay. So, as we said last week, today we would focus on the numbers of the numbers of mineral, which is why it's more than one page. It's not like complicated sources as much as it's, you know, numbers just take up space. Yeah, not even such long even, but it's just a lot. Okay. So, as we know, Bamidbar starts with the census of the Jewish people. We dealt with last week whether this census is the same census as the one we had in Parshas Ki Tisa, considering it has the same number of 603,550. Is it not? Were there two? Was it one continuous one? If it is the same, if it's two different ones, so how do you have the exact same number of people, at, you know, with a period of time in between? Did it depend who counted, etc.? But the even bigger question is what I called here the biblical population explosion. And this is one of the, this is, like, for biblical critics, this is one of the first places they go. But the question really does jump out at you, which is trying to figure out how we got to this number, whatever exactly number you think it is and what census you think it is. The math is quite difficult because if we just take the numbers that we know, so if you look at number one, right, the number, as I said, the number in the end, at the end of this census, is 603,550. But this is only 210 years after the Jews go down to Mitzrayim, which in number two we know, when they got down to Egypt, they were at 70. So we're talking 210 years of population explosion of 70 to 603,550 men between the age of 20 and 60, so a total number of about 2 million, which is an incredible population explosion, and mathematically approaches impossible. So the question is, how do you get there, right? There's other problems. It's not just, right, it's not just the 70 to 603,550 that is the problem. The pasuk continues here in Shmot that Yosef and his brothers died, that the Jews multiplied greatly, they were fertile and prolific, but still, right, this is more than just regular. We'll see that Chazal will pick up on this, but it's an incredible population explosion. But there's other problems. You look at number three, so also from Parshat Bamidbar. In Bamidbar, you don't just have the census of the Jews as a whole, you also have the census of the firstborns who are then redeemed for the Levium. So the Torah tells us that Vichal Bachor Zachar b'mispar shimon b'menchodesh v'mala v'fkudehem shnayim v'esrim elef shlosha v'shivim u'matayim. That the number of firstborns were 22,273. But now if you try to do the numbers, right, if per family there's one firstborn and there's 603,550 people, just men, right, even if there were no other people, that means you have approximately 30 children per family, right, to get to the number, right? This is, right, also a mathematical difficulty, right? I mean, you know, well, this is average, right? It's an average of 30, right, or so. And, of course, it's more than that once you get to the 2 million. So problem one, right, in the numbers is how do we get from 70 to 603,550? Two is, How do you have 603,550 if there's only 22,273 firstborns? The third problem is that the Torah itself, 2 million people is a lot of people, right? 2-3 million people is a lot of people, especially when you think that modern Israel has only about 7 million people. So 3 million people is how many people they had in the modern state until, not so long ago. And yet, if you look at number four, when God tells the Jewish people about their experience as they enter Israel, he says as follows, Lo argashenu mipanecha b'shana achat, peniyeh ha'arit shmama v'raba alecha chayat asadeh. God says, look, I'm going to kick out the nations slowly, and I'm not going to kick them all out at once, because if I do, the country will be desolate, and the animals, right, the wild beasts, will multiply and they'll hurt you. So instead, instead I'll drive them out little by little until you are populous enough to possess the land. But this is a strange problem. God is claiming that the Jews don't have enough people at the time of when they enter the country to populate it in such a way that it won't just be, you know, the outback with wild animals running everywhere. But 2.5-3 million people, which is about half the modern state of Israel now, a third of the modern state of Israel, that's more than populous enough, right? People aren't living in apartment buildings, right? If nowadays there's about 7 million people, including the apartments in Yerushalayim and Haifa and Tel Aviv and the big cities, you know, in a world where people aren't living in multi-floored houses, you know, maybe multi-family houses, but not in, you know, skyscrapers, 2.5 million people, 3 million people is more than enough to create a country which feels full, that feels civilized. So problem one is that the number 603,550 seems like a lot when you're coming from 70, only 210 years later. The second problem, which breaks into two, is that the Torah itself seems to indicate that there aren't that many people, because the number of firstborns does not correlate to the number of people that exist, and the Torah itself recognizes that there aren't so many people. There aren't even enough to populate the small little country that we call Israel. And in 5, in Dvarim, the Torah tells you explicitly that lo meirubchem mikol ha'amim, chashak alonai bochem, vayivchar bochem, ki atem ha'ma'ad mikol ha'amim. God says explicitly, I didn't choose you because you're numerous, because you're not, you're of the smallest of the nations. Now, nowadays, sure, 2.5 million people is not so big, but remember, the population explosion that we know about, like in the modern world, only started after the economic revolutions. Like, it's just the last few hundred years where we went, basically the world population had grown only incrementally until like the 1800s. You know, now that we have billions of people, that's very, very new. 2.5 million was a decently sized population. What do you mean you're the smallest of all the nations? So on the one hand, the number seems very strange. And then, secondly, you have these multiple indications in Torah that there aren't so many Jews. So how, if there aren't so many Jews, why does it seem like the Torah says that there's, you know, 2-3 million Jews wandering around at this time? Another problem, another indication there aren't so many Jews, if you look in 6 and 7. 6 describes when the Jews traveled, right? How did the Jews travel? So the Pesukim describe it as follows. And as we read the Pesukim, keep in mind how likely this smooth traveling would go if you had 2.5 million people to move. Right, so this is how the Pesukim go. Vayitnatzlu bnei Yisrael et yam mehar chorev. So the Jews remove their finery on Har Sinai. V'moshe yikach et ha'ol v'natalo michus ha'machaneh archeik min ha'machaneh v'kar lo ol moed. V'yakom v'vakesh adonai yitzeh ol moed asher michus ha'machaneh. Moshe would go outside of the tent. Let's skip down to Yud. Just go to Yud. V'ra'ach ol ha'am et ha'muna anan omeid petach ha'ol v'kam cholom v'shtach ha'vu ish petach ha'alo. I put the wrong one here. Okay, yeah, I'll leave this here. But I put the wrong description of it here. But the Pesukim elsewhere describe that the Jews would travel, right, as soon as the cloud would lift, the Jews would travel. But as Dr. Josh Berman notes in 8, an encampment of 2 million, equivalent to the population of Houston, Texas, would have taken days to traverse. Yet the Torah does not remark upon that either, instead describing Israelites routinely exiting and returning to the camp with ease. Oh no, this is the Pesukim, right? He's just saying people come in and out, right? If you go back to the Pesukim in 6, right, it's whenever Moshe would go out of the tent, the people would rise and stand, whenever at the entrance of their tent, and they would look at Moshe, and then they would go home. Right? People were just in and out, the whole camp would move. Right? Every time Moshe would move, the whole camp would move. So this is the size of Houston, Texas. Right? Or in modern Israel, it's the size of it's the population of Yerushalayim and Tel Aviv combined, plus something, probably Yerushalayim, Tel Aviv, and Haifa or something. Right? I have to look at the exact numbers. But, you know, if you ever try to go, you know, if you ever go to these, like, rallies, you know, with 5,000 people, or, you know, I remember the when I was in eighth grade, we had like this big rally in Washington, 100,000 people. Trying to get 100,000 people to travel calmly, walk calmly, is impossible. 2.5 million people, right? They're not, you know, one person, Moshe gets up, goes to the tent, everyone on cue stands up, travels in, out. It's impossible. And he said, nor does it register the bedlam and gridlock that would have been created by the system of centralized sacrifices mandated in the book of Leviticus. Is that you have karbanot coming all the time. If people are bringing karbanot in and out of this little camp, right, you know how impossible it is. He said in Exodus 15:27, moreover, and this is, if you look at 7, go back to 7 for a moment, right? The Jews leave Mitzrayim. At some point, they don't have food. So God says, don't worry, I'll send you to an oasis. Vayavo Elima. Visham Shtemisre Einot Mayim. Vishivim Tamarim Echnusham Alamayim. All the Jews go, and there's 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees, and they're fine at this little oasis. 70 palm trees for 2.5 million people is not, it's just, it's impossible. It's literally impossible. Right, so Dr. Berman notes, he said, in Exodus 15:27, moreover, the Israelites are reported camping in a particular desert oasis that boasted 70 date palms, which for a population of 2 million would have to have fed and sheltered 30,000 people per tree, right, by simple mathematics. So the problem, the biblical population explosion problem, has two very different components to it. One is it's very hard to figure out how we got from 70 to 2-3 million people in 210 years. The second problem is the Torah itself, while it claims that there's these 2 million people walking around, has many indications that there aren't 2 million people walking around, because A, the number of people there can fit at an oasis with 70 trees, right? B, they can travel with ease, right? They're constantly in, out, bringing karbanot, traveling across the desert. It sounds like it's an instant procedure, not one which takes months every time you want to move. Three, the number of firstborns, which is only 22,000 and change, would lead to families of at least 30 per family, right? Which mathematically seems extremely unlikely. Four, God himself says the Jews are the least numerous of the peoples, but 2.5 million people is pretty numerous in the time, in the biblical period. And five, God says he's not going to drive the people of the land out quickly, because if he does, the land will become desolate. But again, if there are 2.5 million people to populate that land, it isn't going to be desolate. It's going to be, you know, not, again, not skyscrapers, but it'll be similarly populated geographically to modern Israel. Maybe slightly less, but, you know, give or take, it's not that different from what a modern country looks like. So what do you do, right? How do you deal with this problem and explain what is going on with the numbers, right? If it's literal, how did we get to these numbers? And how do you solve all those problems? If it's not literal, then why does the Torah tell you that there are 600, right? It's not like it's a metaphorical number. You know, it's like sometimes people say, oh, there's 1 million people there. That sounds like an exaggeration. 603,550 is a very odd number to pick if you're not literal, right? So what would it mean if it wasn't literal? How would you even get there? So I'll, you know, give away the ending right now, which is that I'm not going to be able to solve the problem perfectly. I'm going to outline different approaches that have been taken, but in the end, you know, it's a problem, right? Here we're highlighting the problem. I'm debating what the best way to do this. You know, okay, I could, okay, for organization, I'll just follow the sources I have it, even though I could have reorganized it a bit. Okay, so possibility one is the Midrashic direction. The Midrash tries to solve the problem, at least the first problem, of how did we get from 70 to 2 million? And that is with a very well-known Midrash, which we tend to, you know, we say it in the Haggadah, but we don't think about the mathematical problem it's trying to solve. But that's the Midrash in Shemot Rabbah number 9. Uvenei Yisrael paru vayishritzu. The Jewish people reproduced and spawned. Right. Even though Yosef and his brothers had died, their God didn't die. God was still there, making sure the Jews were prosperous. That even after the Shvatim died, the Jews were multiplying. So the first possibility in the Midrash just means Paruva Yeshutsu means, yes, they had children. They were living. But the second version of the position of the Midrash is no. Not just they were prosperous. Every time they gave birth, they had sextuplets. Every time. Right? Every single birth. So if the average woman gives birth four times, she would give birth to 20. She would have a minimum of 24 children. Shne Emar, Uvene Yisrael, Paru, Vayishritzu. Because they were, right, they were spawning like Vayishritzu is from, right, insects. Right, they spawned like insects, and insects give birth to multiple all at once. So we weren't just fruitful, we were like flies. We were just multiplying at astounding rates. Yeshom rim shneimasar. Some say it wasn't six, it was 12. Dichtiv paru shnayim veshritzu shnayim veribu shnayim vatzmu shnayim b'maod maod shnayim vatzim alei aretz adam shnayim, because they read in each of the plural languages, paru is two, right? They were they reproduced, that's two, at least two. Veshritzu, and they spawned, is another two. Vayirbu, and there was a lot of them, it's another two. Vayatzmu, and they were great, two. B'maod maod, a lot, that's two. Vatzim alei, and they feel plural, that's two. Areshnei masar, it's 12. Vayatzmu, Yeshomrim Shisha Bikar Zechad, and some say Vayatzmu is six at once. V'al Titma, and don't be surprised that they could do this. Sheharei Akrav, Shehim and Ashratim, and this is where they play on the linguistic point. Don't be surprised, because scorpions, which are of the Shratim, are of the bugs, which is the Shoresh for the word, Vayishritzu, Yoledet Shivim, it gives birth to 70 at a time. So the Midrash is clearly trying to solve the population explosion problem and saying, well, everyone gave birth to at least six at a time, or maybe 12 at a time, and therefore, so let's take 12 at a time. Let's say the average woman has four or five children. That means the average woman was having 48 to 60 children in her lifetime, right? So there you go, right? Now, right, ostensibly, so great, that solves your population explosion. You do that for 210 years, right? And, you know, the numbers will work out. You know, you combine whatever assumptions you want to of how young people were getting married, and you could, right, you can do it, right? You know, the math will be a bit tricky, but it'll work out, right? So if you take 70, you know, okay, let's say, right, so 70, let's say they were getting married and having children at 15, right, 14, 15, right? So you could do it, 210 years, you're talking, you know, almost 15 generations of, you know, so 70 to the, you know, and you're, you know, putting this to exponent, you're going to get the number, it's a lot, right? But, okay, so that's how you solve the problem, great. Now, you're still going to have, so that sort of solves one problem. Now, you're going to have another problem, two more problems, right? One is going to be, it still doesn't explain all the indications in the Torah that there aren't so many people, right? And you're just going to have to go through each one and say, well, yeah, they were magical trees, and each one of the trees could provide for 30,000 people. You're going to have to say that. You don't have a choice, right? You're going to have to go midrashically and say, yes, each of the trees was a magic tree, and it produced enough dates for 30,000 people. Sure. You're going to have to say that when God said you're the fewest among the nations, okay, he doesn't mean the fewest, I don't know, or he means, or maybe he's looking at the whole Middle East as one big nation. I don't know. You'll have to come up with some midrashic explanation. How are you going to deal with the travel problems? It was the greatest miracle in the desert, that people were orderly, right? They listened. They moved smoothly. There was no traffic, right? You're going to have to go point by point. Now, what about the Bechor problem? So if you really think every family had 60 kids, so you can solve the Bechor problem also. Yeah, there's a total, right? 22,000 firstborn, 600,000 men. Okay, so that means even if there are only men, so there'd be 30 kids per family, you double it. Okay, there's 60 kids per family. Now, the truth is you're still not there. So you need more like, you know, from 22,000 to 2 million, you need more like 100 kids per family. So even by the most exaggerated interpretation of the Midrash, right, you get to a problem. Now, you can, if you want, in Midrashic fashion, answer it up locally. So, for example, Rav Henkin tries this, Rav Yehuda Erzelhenkin tries this, based on a famous midrash in 10. Again, these are like all midrashim that we read during Pesach over and over again. So Rashi on the Maka of Choshech, on darkness, says, why was it that it was dark for 6 days? So he quotes the Midrash in Shemot Rabbah as follows. He says, it was dark for 3 days. Choshech shel ofel, shelo ra'u ish et achiv otan shlosh yamim. There was a pure gloom for 3 days where no one saw each other. Ve'od shlosh yamim acherim choshech b'chupal mizel zeh. And then a doubled darkness for another 3 days. Shelo kamu ish mitachtav yoshev ein yachol la'amod ve'omeid ein yachol leishev. If someone was standing, couldn't sit. If he was sitting, couldn't stand. Ve'lama hevi aleim choshech. Why did God bring darkness? Shehayu b'Yisrael ba'od do'ador rishayim lo yerotim latzeit. Because there were evil people who didn't want to leave. Umeitu bishloshet yemei afela, and they died during the days of darkness. Kadesh lo yiru mitzrim v'avatalam v'yomru afem lokim kamonu. So the Egyptians wouldn't see them and gloat and say, look, they're being struck just like us. Va'od shechipsu Yisrael v'roet kileihem, and the Jews needed time to find all the gold and silver of Egypt. Kishatu v'yoshua liman v'yomru ein biyadenu klum. So when the Jews would ask the Egyptians for money before they left, and they would deny that they had anything, Omer lo, they would say, no, I know, ani re'itiv b'beit chav makomploni hu, I saw it in such and such a place. Rav Henkin, in number 11, in his, what was originally published as an addendum to his tshuvot, Chibah Yeterah, but he published it as a separate book in English, New Interpretations on the Parsha, tries to combine all the midrashim to solve the problem, and he says, perhaps, initial miscarriages resulted from slavery, malnutrition, and child marriages were prevalent in Egypt, and these deny the status of firstborn to subsequent live births. So he said, possibility one is, yes, there were a lot of children, but just because they were having a lot of children doesn't mean that, as was common in those days, they didn't also have children death. And usually, people, right, the first birth was the hardest. I don't know if that's true scientifically. It's probably not, but fine. So maybe, yeah, there were a lot of people per family, but the firstborns died disproportionately, because, you know, people got healthier, they got more used to delivery by child 65, I guess, right? They have practice, I don't know, right? But the firstborns would die. Or, and then he quotes this midrash, he says, there may have been a few firstborns in the first census in the desert because few elected to leave Egypt where they were a privileged class. So here he suggests something clever. He said, maybe that there was a disproportionate number of firstborns in that who didn't want to leave Egypt. Why would that be true? Because firstborns are always the privileged class. So, you know, again, they were all slaves. But in the hierarchy, if the Midrash tells us that there was 80% of the Jews who didn't want to leave, let's say, the firstborn slaves are a slightly higher status on the totem pole than the non-firstborn slaves because of primogeniture and all the advantage we give to firstborns. So maybe there was a disproportionate number of firstborns who didn't go out of Egypt. So when there's only 22,000 firstborns, when you get to this point, it's not because there was 60 children per family or 100 children per family. It's because they disproportionately chose not to leave, but there were at some point many more firstborns, right? Which is a very midrashic, localized midrashic way of combining two midrashim to solve the problem, right? He said the midrash offers another possibility. The Torah employs six verbs to describe the fecundity of Israel in Egypt, and the midrash sees this as an allusion which that the Jewish women gave birth to six stoplets. If so, 10 pregnancies per mother would yield 60 offspring, of which only one would be firstborn, half of the children of the firstborn would be males, and one male firstborn for every 60 male births. That otherwise, you just take the assumption, right, that yes, everyone had six stoplets, and everyone therefore had 60 children, right, 22,000 to 600,000, we said, means there's 30 people per birth, but it's not really true, because only the males are being counted, so that's only half the number of firstborns that exist, which means there's 40,000 firstborns, 44,000 firstborns to 600,000, so sure, it would be for every 60 males, there's one firstborn. Okay, we can work out the numbers. Now, there's another problem, which I didn't get to yet, but is the third census in Bar Midbar is the Levium, and the Levium, again, are 22,000 people, give or take, right? They're within a few hundred of the Bechor, which is why the end of Parshat Bereishis deals with the trades between, you know, the redemption of the firstborns by the Levium. Right, so there's only 22,000 Levim, which again is disproportionate to the rest of Klal Yisrael. So here he picks up another midrash, which is that the many of the midrashim say that the reason that the Jews were so fruitful is because kasher ya'anu oto kenu, right? As the pasuk says, the more that the Egyptians tortured them, so the more they were fruitful. But in the midrashic world, the Levim aren't enslaved, and if they aren't enslaved, they don't get the blessing of increased fertility. So therefore, it makes sense that both the firstborns and the Levim are less numerous proportionally than everybody else. And that's how Rav Henkin deals with it. So one way of dealing with this problem is to work within the world of Midrash and then try to solve each problem. Okay, how do we get from 70 to 2 million? Well, everyone had 60 children, right? How do you explain the number of firstborns? Two possibilities. Either, yes, in fact, there's only one firstborn for every 60 people because, you know, you multiply the number of firstborns by 2 for the girls, and then you figure it out, so there's 45,000, whatever it is, firstborn, 600,000 people. Okay, so, you know, we work it out. Yeah, there are a lot of people per family. We know that, right? Or for 2 million people, whatever it is. So, yeah, so one firstborn per, and every family had 50 people. Okay. Or you say maybe the firstborns isn't indicative of how many people there were, because maybe the firstborns in the Midrashic world were disproportionately advantaged, and therefore they didn't want to leave Egypt if they didn't want to leave Egypt, so they stayed. But that doesn't mean that that's representative. The Levim, their numbers are disproportionate. Okay, maybe they didn't suffer. If they didn't suffer, they weren't enslaved, so there aren't so many of them. So that's one direction that would solve Midrashically, or, like I said, the number problem. What it doesn't solve is the second half of the problem, which is, okay, if you really do have 2.5 million people, then how are you traveling with these? Why is the country going to be desolate? Right? How are they supported by 70 trees? Right? None of those questions are solved by the Midrash, and you have to leave it, but Sarach Ian, right? You have to leave it, I don't know, right? There, you're just going to have to try to solve each one, you know? Now, to be fair, you can, right? Meaning, once you're willing to accept the Midrash as literal, that every family has 60 children or 100 children, so why not believe that there are magic date trees that can serve 30,000 people each? Meaning, I don't think a tree that can serve 30,000 people is any more miraculous than a woman giving birth to 60 or 100 children in her life. Meaning, once you're in that world and you're accepting the possibility of 60 children per family, 100 children per family, so sure, accept magic trees and accept... You can, yeah.
Isn't the problem with the Levim the other way? If there's 22,000 for one Shevet and 32,000 from all the others...
No, 32,000 is the minimum of any other Shevet.
Oh, the minimum from one Shevet.
From right. Okay. Menashe is the smallest one after Levi, it's 32,000, but yeah, like yeah. Yehuda, for example, if you look, has 74,270, if I remember that correctly.
No, all the firstborn came to 22,273.
Sorry, 74,600. 74,600.
What's 22,273? That's all.
Is the firstborn. The Levium total is 22,000. The Levium total is 22,000. The firstborns of everyone together is 22,000.
Okay.
Right, because the Levium end up redeeming, the Levium non-firstborns end up redeeming the firstborns of everybody else. Or, yeah, there's approximately the same number of Levim as there are firstborns in the other Shvatim. That's the number that we get to. So solution one, let's say, is the Midrashic solution. And as you see with Rav Henkin, one way of dealing with this is to accept basically the Midrashic theories, and then each time you have a local problem, to tweak it and say, okay, you have a problem with magic trees? Accept that there's magic trees. Like, just, you know, once you're in the Midrashic world, you can do that. The second derech, the second approach, is I think the one I would probably take, is what the Ibn Ezra does, which is to say, I have absolutely no idea. I don't know. All right, I'm not the first person. It's not like we're the first people to pick this up. You look at number 12. So the pasuk says, "Vayasev Elohim et ha'am derech midbar yamsuf v'chamishim alu v'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim." That God led the Jews in a roundabout way by the yamsuf, and then they went up armed. So there's a midrash that we quote in the around Pesach time that chamushim. means that only, not that they were armed, but that one-fifth or one-fiftieth or one-five-hundredth of the Jewish people left Egypt. So Ibn Ezra picks up on this midrash, and he says, "Vidarash alu echad mechamesh meot." That midrash that says that the Jews who left was only 1 in 500 of the Jews who were there. So, right, quick math here, right, that means that if there were approximately 2 million Jews that left Egypt, according to this calculus, right, that means there were, right, 1 billion Jews. Yes, right, 1,000 million. So, yes, 1 billion Jews in Egypt, right, which is significantly more than the population of the entire world until, like, 1800, right, or 1700, or whatever it is, right? That is, so the Ibn Ezra says, "Darash alu achad mechash meot davar yachid hu." That is a singular position. It's a lone opinion. "V'alav machloket," and it is debated. "V'einena kabbalah klal." This is not part of our received tradition, which we're bound to. Why? He says, "V'day lanu atzar shanachnu bo imchach me'ishmael." Right? He said, "I have enough grief from that the Muslim scholars give me." He said, "How in God's name did you get from 55 males, right, 70 people, 55 males to 200, right, to 2,600,000 males in 210 years, right? We're not even counting, right? It's so much more with the women and children, because we didn't even count that. And of the 70 who went down to Egypt, he said, that's not fair. It's not really 70. 70 includes Yaakov, who already finished having children, right? It's not like 70 people who are now having children. It's 70 including the parents, right, who are not having any more children. And to be fair, most of the Shvatim weren't having children. It's 70 people including all the generations. You're talking, you know, 2 million people from the 35 children that came down to Egypt. He said, "Kilo matano echosh rak al yordim mitzrayim v'lo safru abanot." He said, "Uchuvatenu." Said, my answer is, "Kine Yaakov levado holid barbeim v'sheish shanim samach tet panim v'nei banim alzam mispar yichpalu kiflei kiflaim ezbar katuv." Right, he said, you'll have to, like, come up with the number that, okay, if I multiply it, great, kiyaz ha-shivu v'anu od, but then they ask me if that's true, "Ki Yaakov v'anav lo din l'kevot ki mishtayim." Right, then they turn back to me and say, okay, I don't understand the numbers, but also I don't understand, how does nobody in Yaakov's family have girls? Right, there's no girls, there's Dina and there's Sarah, the whole, the everything about Yaakov's family is so bizarre mathematically. And that was a miracle. And he said, besides, even the 70, Yaakov became 70 because he had four wives. Maybe, who says that his children had multiple wives? Like, there's so many assumptions. So he goes through, well, you could try, you could do the numbers, I can come up, right? He has all these different mathematical things, right? And then he goes through Makat Choshech. Rabbi said, if you add the Makat Choshech thing, you're just making this impossible for us, right? Because then I have to multiply this by 500, and I have to explain. I have difficulty enough getting from 70, Bekoshi 70, to 2 million. My wildest mathematical imagination, I can't get from 70 to a billion. So if you look at the just the last line, skip down. He said, "Vizeh hefech hakatuv klal drashu." He said, "This is all against the psukim. It's just a homiletic. The endless mochalav. Don't rely on it. Ulay shamru b'tchila yosod. Maybe there's some secret to it." But basically, the Ibn Ezra says, "Look, I get it. I can try to work out the numbers, but it's really hard. And please, I have enough trouble with it. Don't make my life harder." Meaning, at some level, the Ibn Ezra just said, "Look, I get it. It's a problem. It is a problem. I don't know what to do with it, but it is what it is." Right, which is basically my approach, which is, okay, I could do what Rapenkin's doing and try to work out all the calculus. In the end, you know, as they say, you don't die from a question. Okay, I can't quite work it out, but okay. You know, so possibility one is to try to, you know, use the midrash to work at every possibility. Possibility two is to recognize there's a problem and recognize there's a problem. But then there are attempts to provide answers to this. So if you look at 14, I gave you a summary of them. Well, first, before I get to A, B, right? The Bible critics just use this as evidence that Mitzrayim never happened, right? You know, they look at all these numbers and they say, Lo hayah v'lo nivra, it can never have been. This whole thing makes no sense. The whole thing is crazy. And because the numbers don't make sense, the whole thing, it just didn't happen. Now, others suggest in C, I told you that maybe the numbers don't make sense, but the Torah exaggerates. You know, some have said, okay, so there weren't 2 million people. The Torah exaggerates. The problem, obviously, with saying it's an exaggeration is not that the Torah doesn't exaggerate. The Torah does exaggerate, right? That's for sure. The Torah uses hyperbole, like every, you know, like modern writers use hyperbole. But like I said, when you use hyperbole, it's usually not 603,550, right? It's usually a billion, right? A million. It's a nice round number, right? Most people don't exaggerate to... Look, it's a weird exaggeration. It's a weird thing to say, well, yes, we actually hold multiple censuses, which all come to the exact same number, but we've exaggerated. Yehuda didn't have 74,600. They had 3,000, but we rounded up to 74,600. Like, it's a very... Okay, I mean, sure, it could be, but it's a little bit weird. Others suggest, again, I don't find this compelling, at least in this case, that maybe... This number isn't meant to convey who was in the desert. It means it's in the process of redemption, and they're referring to some generation in the future, which in this case I don't find compelling. It's true, it is true, that Tehillim Tetvav, Kuf Tetvav, meaning B'tzeit Yisrael Mimitzrayim, Beit Yaakov Mem Lo'ez, I tell you, right, etc. B'tzeit Yisrael Mimitzrayim, two psukim later you hear, Yarden, right? You hear about the crossing of the Yarden, which means that in the view of Tanakh, Yitzhak Mitzrayim ends 40 years after they leave Mitzrayim. It's a process of 40 years. It's true, but it doesn't sound like, therefore, when Moshe does the census, he's not really doing the census. The census is happening 40 years later. It doesn't sound that way, right? It's true. Sometimes we're talking about unfolding processes, but it doesn't sound that way. These censuses sound like they happen in Mitzrayim. The most sort of coherent approach that's been suggested, though it also has problems, is what I put here in A. It's been suggested by many, and I put here, including fascinatingly enough, by David Ben-Gurion, who wrote, if you didn't know, a Perush on Tanakh. Yes, so David Ben-Gurion has a Perush on Tanakh. It's called Iyunim B'Tanakh, he loved Tanakh. So he wrote one, and he devotes 10 pages to this topic. And he suggests, and this has been suggested by many people since him, that the numbers were just wrong. Elef doesn't mean 1,000. Elef sometimes means 1,000, but sometimes it means aluf, which is a contingent. Right. So when it says shivim elef, it doesn't mean 70,000. It means 70 groups of whatever. It could be 70 groups of 50. It could be 70 groups of 30. It's a military encampment. Right, so what it's telling you is there's 70 groups, and 600,000 isn't 600,000, it's 600 groups. Now, the big problem with this is, which I put here, is the hundreds and tens, right? Meaning, if you look at the psukim, right, so sure, 600,000, if the only number I had to work with was 600,000, right, so then I could say it doesn't mean 600,000, it means 600 contingents in the army. And that would be really easy. But in our parsha, that's really hard, because how do you read it? 600 groups and then 3,050, right? Like, normally, if you have three places, if the third place is the tens place and the second place is the hundreds place, the first place is the thousands place. It's not groups, hundreds, tens, it's thousands, hundreds, tens. So people, again, certain Bible critics who are, I guess, relatively traditional, not traditional, who are willing to play with the text of the Torah, say that it's a scribal error. It never said 603,550, whatever. It said 600,000 groups of 3,000 and, you know, or something like that, plus 3,000, you know. But again, that doesn't really work from a traditional perspective, because you have to play with the text. So none of these solutions are really smooth. Again, the Aluf one, minus the hundreds and tens problem, does come the closest to solving the problem, because then it says, yes, there were, I don't know. Now, some of the scholars really go and input the charts. They go very carefully and they try to figure out, okay, how many, what were the numbers? How many people were in it? How do you count all the numbers? You know, so they'll read it like 74,600 means 7 means, right, 70 groups of 4,600 people, which is reasonable, right? You can have 4,600 people divided into groups of 70. That's not crazy. And they go through each shavit and they do it. Again, so that's a variety of academic approaches to it, which is, again, either, you know, at the extreme. Again, none of this, most of these are not things that traditionally you can accept, like the Torah isn't true, right? That's obviously not something I accept. Or it's an exaggeration, which, again, it sometimes might be the case. Here it's a bit hard because of the precision of the census. Or this notion that Aluf means clan, which it could be, but again, it creates problems in terms of the hundreds and tens places in the Torah. So, like I said, I'm not coming to a final conclusion here. It's but I wanted to do was highlight the problems. Again, to summarize it, there's two types of problems. One is simply, how do we get from 70, which isn't really 70, as the Ibn Ezra notes. It's 70 people, not 70 people who can now have children, to 2 million people, 3 million people, 210 years later. That problem, so midrashically, we can solve by saying they had an insane number of children. How do you solve the Bechor problem? Well, if it's really big families, there's a lot of Bechor, there's very few Bechors for big families. Or alternatively, as Rav Henkin suggests, maybe the Bechors disproportionately never left Egypt. Why are there so few Levim? Maybe they weren't as fruitful as everybody else. Then there's a second set of problems, which is, okay, but the Torah itself, besides for the actual numbers, seems to indicate there aren't that many Jews, because God says they're few, because they're able to travel with ease, because they're able to be supported by 70 trees worth of dates, because God tells them that if they go into the country, they won't be able to populate it. How do you solve those problems? Again, either you try to solve it midrashically, that's possibility one. Possibility two is to say, it's a problem. I understand that there are possible solutions. I can't work it out until the end, but that's okay. We don't die from questions, which is basically what the Ibn Ezra does. Right? He said, look, I can point you in certain directions, but you're right. There's going to be some things I can't quite work out the details. And then there's the biblical critical approach, which is to say maybe we misunderstand, you know, either, you know, let's take the first one here, the Aluf one, that we misunderstand it, that it doesn't mean there were 600,000 people. It means there were 600 clans. And in fact, there are only several tens of thousands of Jews, and therefore, that solves everything. You know, a camp of, let's say, 50,000 people can travel with relative ease. You know, it can. It's not that easy, but an orderly camp of 50,000 people can move, right? Meaning, it's true. You know, the Israeli Day Parade, sure, you get 100,000 people, they can march. It's a bit rowdy, but, you know, you move. You get through it. It's a few blocks worth. If you take that approach, then yeah, that's they travel. That's why God is telling them that they can be supported by a little oasis. That's why God is telling them that he can't drive out all the nations because they're not populous enough to take the country. This takes a total rethinking of what Yetziat Mitzrayim looked like, because it's not 600,000 anymore. It's 600 clans. It's a group of, you know, 50,000 people. It's about, you know, the Jewish population of Toronto, essentially, right? You're not talking a massive nation. You're talking a community's worth. But those are sort of the approaches that exist. Okay. 3:22. So I'm debating whether just to keep this. Okay, the second thing I said I would do, you know, I'll do it mostly outside, because it's not an exciting topic that I want to spend a lot of time on, but it is an important topic, is, okay, after we've solved all that, which is complicated, it's the question I asked my seventh grade teacher, which is, why are all numbers in the Torah round? Right? So basically everything is round to the nearest 100, except for God, who's rounded to the nearest 50, which is just, you know, statistically unlikely. So here, there's already a very traditional line of thought that says that, the Torah is just rounding. And this is already found in the Rishonic period, in the medieval period. The Rush, right, Rabbeinu Asher, one of the main halachic authorities that Shulchan Aruch bases himself off, one of the big three, as well as the Tosfot Rid, both say this. They say, yeah, the Torah always rounds, and they prove it with famous examples. Shavuot, we say, is 7 weeks and 50 days. So the Tosfot Rid just says, yeah, because the Torah rounds. We know it's 49 days, but the Torah will sometimes use a round number, 50. It rounds. Or the Rush says, well, the Torah says that you should get 40 malkot, right? 40 lashes. And the Chazal say 40 doesn't mean 40, it means 39. It means three groups of 13, because they would divide the lashes equally between the right different parts of the body, the stomach, the back. So the Rush says, well, Chazal clearly have no problem, because they say that 40 is really 39. It's just, you know, 40. So the Rush and the Rid say, how is it that all the numbers are round? Because the Torah rounds. You're right. They're not perfectly round. It's not some miracle of math, right? It was exact. Everything worked out perfectly to the hundreds. It's a rounding. So then, okay, why, if we're okay with rounding, are 11 of the Shvatim rounded to the nearest 100, and God is rounded to the nearest 50? Right? That's a very technical problem. Very technical. Professor Eli Merzbach, who's I gave you in 16, he's a professor of mathematics at Bar Ilan, he said, well, it's pretty simple, as follows. He said, just look at the A's and B's over here, right? He said, when the figure obtained is in whole tens, the Torah records it as is, without rounding it. He says, well, the Torah only rounds if you're not at a whole 10. Now, what's the chances that a shevet will be on a perfect 10, right? So it's a 1 in 10 chance. So we said, well, if you have 12 tribes, the chances that one of them will be on a perfect 10, and therefore you won't bother rounding, and everybody else was in the middle, is actually what you would basically expect statistically, right? Because you have a 1 in 10 chance of being on a 10. So if you have 12 shvatim, one or two shvatim statistically will have a perfect round number of shvatim. So he said, yeah, that's what happened. 11 shvatim had, I don't know, 74,603. And the other one had, you know, whatever number. God happened to end on a round number, so the Torah, once you're at a round number, doesn't bother rounding to the nearest 100. It just leaves it. It happened to be a 50, so it was a 50, right? Statistically, that's actually what you would expect. Right, so he says, when the figure obtained is non-whole tens, the Torah rounds to the nearest 100. The logic behind the system is simple. If a number ending in units already requires rounding, it is rounded to hundreds with some small margin of inaccuracy. But the figure ends in tens, it is left it is. If we examine the data of the Torah, this becomes completely clear. In each of the two censuses of Bnei Israel in the desert, 11 out of the 12 figures are multiples of hundreds, while one, which in ours is God, and in later on in Bamidbar is Reuven, where he ends in 30. He has 43,730, not in this one, but in the end of Bamidbar, and the one before they go into Eretz Yisrael, he has 730. So he said, in each of the senses, one of the Shvatim is not on the hundreds. And he said, yeah, because the rule was, if you didn't have a round number, we rounded to the closest 100. If you hit the tens, we just left you at tens. Statistically, in each census, one or two shvatim is going to have a round number of people, and that's what you have. In Bamidbar, it's God, who's at 50, and at the end of Sefer Bamidbar, it's Reuven, who has 43,730, and therefore, basically, you deal with the statistics, so you have two rules. One is that the Torah does round. Two is the Torah only rounds to the nearest 100 if you aren't at a perfect 10. You have about a 1 in 10 chance. You have a 1 in 10 chance of having a round number. You have 12 shvatim. Therefore, statistically, you likely only have one shevet per census who happens to land on a round number. And therefore, that's what you have. Reuven in the second census and God in the first census happens to round on a round number. So we didn't round them to the nearest 100. And that's the number, right? It's like it's a very simple mathematical equation, okay? Right? Or relatively simple, right? But basically, the word is, right, you round unless you're already at a round number, and you have a 1 in 10 chance of being at a round number. So if you have 12 shvatim, about one shevet is going to be round, and that's what you find in each census. God is a round number in census 1. Reuven is a round number in census 2. Fine. Rav Samit has a problem. And basically, I would summarize it as follows. I'll say it outside, which is, okay, I get rounding to 50, right? Because you could say, right, there's an easier solution here, which is to say the Torah always rounds to the nearest 100 unless you happen to have 50 people. Because if you're 50, you can't round up or down, so you leave it 50, right? That's sort of an easy mathematical, that for me is an easier mathematical claim. The Torah rounds to the nearest 100 unless you're 50, and God happened to be at 50, so we left it at 50, right? That's easy mathematically. So then Rav Samit says, okay, the one outlier then is Reuven in Parshas Pinchas, who has 43,730, which, why would you ever round to 30? So here he says something compelling, I think, which is, when you normally round to the nearest 100, if you don't round to the nearest 100, then you emphasize a lack. Right? Because what you're saying is normally we would round, but here we're trying to make it conspicuous that someone is not there. So he suggests that why is Reuven the only Sheva that ever gets rounded to a 30? Because Parshas Pinchas is trying to, at a certain level, commemorate the death of the rebels of Reuven in the Korach rebellion. Because Dathan and Aviram took all their family members from Reuven and rebelled against Moshe. So what he suggests is that it's deliberately not rounded to remind us that Reuven, in a certain sense, is incomplete, that they lost a contingent of people that no one else had lost, namely that group of people from Dathan and Aviram. So by rounding to 30 instead of to the nearest 100 or the nearest 50, it highlights the fact that Reuven is lacking, and therefore he says what you know, again, his claim is just basically the Torah normally rounds to the nearest 100 or the nearest 50. If it doesn't, that's to draw attention to the fact that there's something incomplete. His theory is that Reuven is incomplete because of the rebels in Korach. You could give any other suggestion. But the upshot of it is that my question in seventh grade, does the Torah round? The answer is yes, it does round. Statistically, it's unlikely that it doesn't round. Why does it round once to 50? Either because we always round to the nearest 100 unless you're at a perfect 10, or because we always round to the nearest 100 unless you hit 50, and then why do we once round to 30? Because we want to call attention to the fact that Reuven is missing people. And again, every time you know, we know this is true. If normally you round things and one time you don't, right? You know, if normally you say, look, that, you know, the milk is $5, it's really $4.99, right? It's because you don't care. If you're paying in change, right, and you say, I have $4.98, it's to emphasize, I need one more cent, right? If it becomes relevant, so you don't round. So that's what he's saying, is that, yeah, the Torah normally rounds. If it's not rounding, it's to remind you that there's a reason we're not rounding. So, again, his claim is that Reuven is because of the loss during Korach. You could give other reasons, but I think his basic claim, that the Torah rounds unless it wants to draw attention to the fact that it's not rounding, is compelling, which explains the round numbers and non-round numbers in the senses. Okay.